We're open for business live.
So, turning now to our studio guest, Johnny Pawlik, founder of Mantra Media Limited. Johnny, good morning. Thanks for joining me.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
So, first of all, Johnny, just tell us a little bit, what is Mantra Media?
So, the formation of Mantra Media was to address a very particular gap in the market within the digital industry, which is around how we kind of facilitate growth through online marketing. So traditionally, you would have an agency, and they would charge you anything from, you know, 2 to 5 or 10K a month, and you wouldn't really know what was happening. So the problem arises, you know, you get this this report at the end of the month. It's usually filled with lots of jargon and technical knowledge that not the, you know, average person knows what's actually happening, and you know, the results are negligible. I thought, actually, let's do something different. Let's see if we can actually give people in these organizations the skills. And I could also see that from a forecasting perspective that there are more digital people in each organization now. So even from SMEs all the way to large organizations, you'll have teams or individuals who are their digital specialist. And the problem arises is experience. And there's no one within the organization who are kind of director level, who have, you know, the brevity of experiences working with lots of different clients to take the leadership of that person. So I work on I guess it's a mixture of consultative and actually doing the work as a basis, going into these organizations, giving them the skills, giving them the one-to-one training, or developing strategies for those teams.
Okay, so an admirable approach in terms of building capacity, developing capacity and skills. Now, let's just unpick a couple of things that you mentioned. You talked about jargon and agencies going in and talking about a lot of jargon. I suppose it's difficult because expertise, skills and experience then bring jargon because they bring specialist knowledge. And if you didn't have the expertise and the skills, you couldn't do what you were doing. But at the same time, the other side is accessibility and not sort of pulling the wool over clients' eyes. And particularly in something that's new in any area of business, there can be people who use jargon as a barrier or to pretend that they have skills. But then there are other people who undoubtedly do have the skills and the expertise who are perhaps trying to use as little jargon as they can. Now, how do you get that balance right? Because obviously you've got the expertise and the experience, and we're going to talk about that in a moment. But there is a need for some of this jargon, isn't there?
There is sometimes. If you're talking about something very specific, say if you're doing some on-site technical SEO work, you need to talk about metadata. You know, need to talk about H1 to H6 tags and all this kind of thing. I'm depending on the organization I'm working with and the obviously the individuals, I can actually show them what these things do. So I'm quite visual as well. I think it's saying something that people aren't familiar with. So if I said muzukashi, which means difficult in Japanese, instead of I could say that, or I could say it's something that's difficult to do, or it's not easy to do. There are different ways, I think, to say everything. And I think that translation process comes into digital. You're absolutely right. It's so difficult to know what somebody's talking about when they really get into the flow. I did a talk recently at Business Sheffield where I spoke about SEO and talked a little bit about my organization. And in that process, somebody put their hand up and said, "What's SEO?" So we do take things for granted sometimes.
And let's just make sure we have answered that particular question, because I know many of our listeners will of course know what SEO is, but let's just provide a quick description for those who don't.
Okay, so SEO is what it stands for, is the acronym is Search Engine Optimization, and it's the process whereby you make a website rank for particular search terms, so keywords that we type into to search for certain things, and to make sure that they gradually go up the ranks for those search terms. So SERPs, which is search engine ranking positions, We want to make sure that local businesses who want to reach their audience are actually reaching the right people for the right search terms. And SEO allows you to do that.
And I alluded to the dark art of SEO when I introduced you. Why is it that people do describe SEO in that terminology sometimes?
There's two factors there. One is the difference between white hat and black hat. So you have people who... So I wrote a piece last December on best practice for 2015. For white hat SEO, which is great, creating really good content, make sure you're engaging with your audience, have some kind of community going on your website, make sure your content is rich, so you've got good images, good videos, having a lot of social engagement. So you've got this constant relationship with your audience. And the more relevant your site becomes because the information, the copy, and the words and images, etc., are engaging people, the better it is. Now, there's been lots of techniques that have gone for many years, kind of really bad link building strategies where people outsource to India or China and their automation of bots and things like that, and or even using, sites that you wouldn't really want to link to, but somebody's linking to those sites so you become popular. That's the dark. That's part of the dark art side, like paying for likes on Facebook, not using pay per click through Facebook, but actually outsourcing it again. Fake people, fake profiles from India,
and people have done that with Twitter as well. Paying for followers.
Yeah. It's something that can damage your brand now. It can damage your website as well because everything's linked, and people forget this. So that's one part of the dark side. Also, there's the dark side is people don't actually explain what they're doing. So they use the jargon to, against dazzle the consumer when they don't need to. Because you can, if somebody owns a business, they're relatively intelligent. They say common sense isn't common in business, but, if you explain something in simple terms, then people usually understand. So I think part of the darkness is that people don't want you to know what they're doing, because if you realise that you might be able to do it yourself, then they can't sell you more products. And I don't work that way. I'd rather, teach that business how to do it the right way. And if I become... if they don't need me after 6 or 12 months, then so be it. They're going to tell 10 other people that I've given these great skills that they can do themselves.
Develop their skills so they can do it. Okay. So I want to go into a few practical pieces of advice that people can use if they're running a business or a social enterprise in terms of SEO and online marketing. But before we do that, I think it'd be interesting to just talk a little bit about your experience as well, because you've set up Mantra Media. But before that, you've had a long career in the industry. You've worked in online marketing for BSkyB. You've launched products such as Now TV, and you've worked in other businesses too. Tell me about your career to date.
I have quite a convoluted career, in all honesty.
Plus being at London Fashion Week as well.
yeah, exactly. So I was actually a musician from the age of 13, yeah. And I toured playing jazz at the Blue Note jazz club scene in Europe. I travelled Poznan, Warsaw, etc. And so I started out as a creative, somebody, didn't believe in money and business and all that. Go, no, be a musician. Never sell out. And I had some really interesting experiences traveling and meeting people in the industry. Unfortunately, I found the music industry quite a dark place to be.
So dark in what ways?
The kind of people and the kind of, not everybody, there are obviously genuine people who love the music, the engineers, the guys who are really passionate about the creativity and stuff like that. But the kind of corporate side of that machine is quite dark.
In terms of exploitative?
Yes, yes. Okay. And you know, it wasn't uncommon that I would be, you know, chased around a front room by a manager who wanted a little bit more than a contract to be signed. So it's those kinds of experiences that really put you off industry.
So you went from one industry of entertainment and one could say exploiting the talent into another in terms of Hollywood.
Yes. Well, I was studying in Oxford and I finished my degree in 2010. And one of my friends was in Captain America, and he stood there talking about how he's been shouted at by Tommy Lee Jones and stuff. And I was thinking, that's pretty cool. I wouldn't mind doing that. So anyway, I kind of put it out there. I really wanted to do this. And next thing I know, a friend of mine is phoning me up saying, hey, you know they're filming X-Men First Class in Oxford tomorrow. And I'm like, really? And they're like, yeah. So me be me, really proactive, get up like 5 a.m, hardly slept because I was so excited, dressed how I thought they'd want me to dress if they put me in the film.
Right.
Scoured Oxford, trying to find where they're filming, blagged my way through 2 sets of security, ended up meeting the third AD, and then actually having a conversation with the casting director, and ended up being in 4 or 5 scenes in the film. So it was, you know, it was one of the... And then that led to doing a few commercials.
Right.
Last film I did was Fast and Furious 6. It's quite fun.
So that's been a positive experience by the sounds of it. Is that something that you are continuing with as well alongside your career?
I do enjoy it. Yeah. I enjoy doing I did a Barbie commercial and things like that, and it is fun, but I'm not serious about it. You know, I've got no ambitions to become famous or be an actor or anything like that. It was never for that for me. You know, being a musician was the love of music. Being an actor was, this is a bit of a laugh. And it's nice to say I've just met James McAvoy and Jennifer Lawrence. You know, it's that kind of thing more than, you know, the other side of it.
Well, again, if something is fun and you can keep it fun rather than it being pressure to earn money from it, then that's quite a good position for you. But the obvious question to ask is the experience of being a musician and working for yourself as a musician and having to having to perhaps protect yourself and your commercial interests as a musician in what was obviously a difficult culture, and the experience of acting, how has that affected your attitude to business, your skills in business, and the way you do business?
I think I'm very lucky. I think what you have in business is you usually have people who invent a product or a service and they're extremely creative, but they don't have the business head. Or you have people who are very kind of financially astute and they have the strong, you know, business skills, but they don't have the creativity. And I think having a creative background and then going to university, because I went late, and then having the kind of commercial side and always being in online marketing as well in some you know, aspects since the age of 18, it's let me bridge the gap between creativity and commerce. And that's allowed me, I think, to create a service where I can kind of look at the future, look at what the demands are, but also have enough of a business head to make it sustainable. I think it's helped me. I think those, and obviously working with lots of different people, you know, around the world, you kind of learn people.
So those people skills are useful or vital, perhaps, in what you do?
Indispensable, yeah. They're paramount because, especially in my industry where people are heavy, you know, looking at a computer for 12 hours a day, never speaking to anyone, and you kind of lose your ability to communicate. And I think... I think that is difficult, and I think I'm lucky in that respect that I am very people focused as well. So I kind of, as I was saying, bridge that gap.
And I actually mentioned London Fashion Week, but we haven't told listeners about that. So let's just pick up on that. That was as a result of project managing and marketing some fashion brands. So what happens? Why do you, how come you find yourself on the catwalk too?
So I was working.
Is it a desperate desire to show off?
It's funny because you know I was interviewed yesterday morning by Come Dine With Me. Yeah. As a prospect to be on the show, they said, "Oh, tell us about London Fashion Week," and I said, "Well, you know, I'm a bit short to be a model." So modelling actually came from music. So my manager, when I was 18, said, "Hey, you can earn some money on the side. Why don't you do a bit of modelling? That you know, it'll just keep you ticking over while the brand of the band is kind of picking up financially." So I was like, "Yeah, that's a good idea," and you know, did some interesting things. You can do some cheesy photography when you're young.
Yep.
I was working with a couple of designers. One of the designers actually really, he kind of said, "Oh, you've got a great look." And, you know, I thought he was just kind of, you know, hot air. But he said, "Yeah, would you stand in and kind of, because, you know, we want a diverse set of models." So at the Montcalm Hotel and London Fashion Week, I ended up in an off-schedule show just doing the catwalk, which was interesting.
And all these, of course, add up to a collection of really interesting experiences, but also stories as well, you know, real life stories that have happened to you that have involved experiences. Now, does that help in terms of your marketing for your current work to be able to show people that you've had a wide range of experience?
I guess it would if I actually utilised it, but I don't. Mm-hmm. My marketing is for my own business is very simple. I let my clients speak for me. So if you go on kind of my LinkedIn and things like that, and I'm you know considered quite influential on LinkedIn because I have thousands of people on there, and a lot of them are followers, not just connections, and a lot of my pieces get thousands of views read around the world, you know, commented and things. So people are drawn to that, and then they see, you know, lots and lots of clients saying really lovely things about what I do and the progress that, you know, I've helped them with their business. So I think first and foremost, having, you know, other businesses really happy with what I do and speaking for me is the main thing. When I meet somebody and they do talk about their industry, so I recently started working with a jewellery brand, 0.925 Jewellery, which is, what she does is amazing. You know, it's hallmarked, handmade, silver jewellery. It's Sheffield silversmith. You know, I love that stuff. I love that stuff
about Sheffield. It's building on Sheffield's heritage.
Exactly. And when I, you know, we were talking about fashion, I was like, "Oh yeah, I know a bit about your industry." And she, you know, she says, "Oh, tell me about that." I said, "Oh, well, I was modelling alongside, you know, some of the girls from the show The Bachelor and Kimberly Spreadway from Britain's Next Top Model at London Fashion Week." And it's that thing of, "Oh right, well, then yeah, you do know about my industry." And it's that kind of, it does help. It does help, but I don't, you know, kind of market it.
Okay, so. All of these experiences, though, point to the fact that you're self-sufficient and you've created your own opportunities as well. So whether it's getting to talk to the assistant director in a Hollywood film in Oxford and blagging your way through to do that, through to being a self-employed musician, through to working in the industry in corporates, but then deciding to set up your own business, mm-hmm. you've demonstrated that you are self-sufficient and you perhaps want to work for yourself. Now, so was it always your dream from an early age to work for yourself, to be in control of what you do?
I think so. I mean, I grew up in a situation where I didn't have, where, you know, I saw my parents work extremely hard. I mean, my parents had me very, very young. And they didn't really have financial support from anywhere. So, you know, we were in a council estate. Some days I couldn't go to school because there was some random dog that looked like it was going to bite somebody's head off outside the front door. When I'm walking to school, you know, 5 years old, I'm trying to avoid syringes on the floor. It was, you see kids, you know, urinating around the street. It's difficult. It's tough. And I watched my parents work so hard. You know, my dad's working like 70, 80 hour weeks, you know, just not stopping to get us out of that situation and in an environment that was safer. And then when I was, you know, just before I was a teenager, my parents moved into a nice, it was a nice area in the sense that there was no fear of walking down the street or you're going to get beaten up or a glass bottle, you know, thrown at your head or whatever. And I guess that coming from that working class background and to know what it's like to struggle and see your parents work so hard to ensure that you have a chance in life, it imbues you with certain values. So I'm very much about giving back, supporting people, helping people get out of those situations that may be detrimental to them or their families.
And has that been one of the reasons why you do CSR work and have done corporate social responsibility work when you've been in larger organisations too? Because I know that's something you've done.
I've always been known as the kind of champion for CSR in other organisations. And it's because I think organisations could give a lot more than they do back to society. I'm very passionate about that. Last year, I did a digital skills outreach project in South Yorkshire, where there was a school that had very, very low attainment levels. The kids were struggling, so I went in and did like a three session course on giving them digital skills and also trying to raise their ambitions, so they realised actually there are opportunities out there. You just have to work hard.
Yeah. And that's a good point to just bring in I mentioned the UK Business Digital Index at the start of the show today, with published by Lloyds Bank in association with a digital skills charity, Go On UK, and Accenture Consulting. And they found that almost a quarter of the UK's SMEs still lack basic digital skills. Mm. So whether it's going out and doing your outreach programs in a capacity as a CSR and voluntary work and trying to put something back, or whether it's the actual business case for businesses to embrace digital and to learn how to do it properly, there's a way to go. And I want to spend just the last few minutes of the interview just giving people a few words of advice based on your experience and your skills in terms of what they should be looking at. If you're a small or even medium-sized business or social enterprise, you know the need to have a website in a way that people really have accepted, but there's still lots of confusion about aspects like SEO and getting good search engine rankings and Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn as marketing. So where would you start with a small organisation?
Well, from a technical point of view, there are basics that you can do. On-site technical SEO, just to make sure that your website functions properly. You can start your social engagement. I guess the first thing that I would say, which is particular about Yorkshire, is don't be scared of change. You know, there's a lot of people that still think putting a poster up down the road is going to be just as effective as doing a pay-per-click campaign, where you can actually target someone with their specific geographical location, what they ate last night. You know, the demographics are so specific, and they cost so little if you do it properly, you know, a few pence per interaction for somebody you know is going to buy your product. You know, it's that kind of... So I think don't be scared of change. Embrace the future and embrace that, you know, there are different forms of marketing now, and they at a lesser cost can actually bring you real results. I think if you're looking at people to acquire those skills, look at what they've done in the past, look at the people they work with and what they say about what they do. Because it's like hiring a financial advisor or, you know, somebody to do your books. You have to trust them, because someone can do a lot of damage if they don't know what they're doing as far as SEO. So, or they just may not have the experience. So there has to be trust. So I guess don't fear, do your research, and then trust who you've got doing it, and make sure that make sure they've got experience in your industry.
So you can see the caliber of the person you're considering, or the person or the business that you're considering bringing in, because if they know what they're doing, they will have the endorsements on LinkedIn.
Yeah,
yeah. And it's interesting that you talk about either fear of change or perhaps resistance to change. Mm. Is that something that you do think is specific to Yorkshire or specific to the north, or
it's difficult because it's marketing automation is kind of standard in America now, and they have quite a bit of it in China as well. So it's everything's automated, and you have these really clever systems that are quite expensive that kind of do everything for you. So your role in the business is almost passive as far as sales coming in. That's not hit the UK yet. The UK still hasn't adopted it, but, you know, I work with guys in the States who do this stuff, and they're just like, why are you guys not doing this? It's amazing. And I think a little bit of that as an SEO, and I do meet people who say, do you think social media is going to work for me? And I kind of like, are you serious? Have you seen the growth this company had last year because they embraced social media? And I think there's a little bit of education that needs to be have. So instead of kind of guessing whether it'll work or not, look at companies that do use it and find out, you know, if they've had growth in the last couple of years. I mean, that's a kind of a key indicator.
We're talking with Johnny Pawlik of Mantra Media, and you're listening to Business Live on Sheffield Live, broadcasting on 93.2 FM and from sheffieldlive.org. across Sheffield and the world. Johnny is an expert in social media marketing, in online marketing, and in SEO, search engine optimization, and is giving a few pieces of advice for listeners running businesses, running social enterprises. Johnny, we've only got a couple of minutes left, unfortunately, and this is a topic that that is vital for businesses to engage with. I just want to run through a couple more tips, pieces of advice. First of all, we've talked about don't be scared of change, because the benefits are enormous and they are measurable as well. Now, let's talk about measurability and return on investment, because some people are quick to dismiss the world of online marketing because they say, well, it doesn't matter if I have 3,000 likes. What's that in terms of sales? How do they measure? How do you actually track results from online marketing? And it's not just Facebook likes, Twitter retweets, and so on. But you know, what do you talk with your clients about in terms of return on investment and measurability?
Well, if you want to be really specific, what you can do is you can organize a pay-per-click campaign on Facebook, where if you align that with your analytic data through your website and you drop a pixel in there as far as your checkout, so where people buy a product, you can actually get that person from, I'm on that Facebook page, I've clicked on that product because that ad you've just showed me on my newsfeed. Now I've gone to the checkout page and I've bought a product. So you can actually track from start to finish, from social to buying the product. As far as what it does, I mean, the first thing is you've got to get an audience, and you've got to get the right audience. There's no, and I'm very big on that. You've got to get the right demographics of the people who want to buy from you. And you've got to keep them engaged. So it has to be kind of a big strategy. It's looking at the big picture. There's lots of different parts to it. So as far as your return on investment, it's imperative that you're engaging with those people and you're consistently telling them about the benefits of their products, say compared to their competitors. You can measure, as I've said, with pixel dropping and things like that. It also inquiries. So when I work with customers on LinkedIn and social enterprises, and I'm saying, you know, you need more corporate investment, and I work with a number of organizations in Sheffield that they need more corporate investment. They're like, how do you speak to these, you know, CSR guys of the Vodafone and everything else? And I said, well, actually, we need to first make you visible. Because there's no point trying to speak to somebody if they you know don't know you're there. So there's a stage of this. But then when you become, and I'm very big on this, is it's making people spokesmen for their industry. So I can only work with one person in a particular industry in a particular area, because I can't represent, you know, two companies that sell the same products in the same area, because then it, you know, it doesn't make sense. It doesn't make sense, and it would be wrong for me to do so. So I think it is about that kind of having a voice, and then making sure you're speaking to the right people, and then attracting that to you, so you're passive. So you get more and more inquiries, people more and more looking at your products, you know, doing the checkout work, and then you actually see the increase and monitor it month on month. Have I increased my website traffic, and has that related to an increase in social and profit? And you monitor that month on month and make sure it does.
Excellent. Well, Johnny, thanks very much for sharing your experience, your advice and expertise with us. People can find out more about you, of course, Johnny Pawlik of Mantra Media. What's the best way for them to do that?
So it depends what you do. I mean, LinkedIn is always a great one. You can send me a message on there. We're on Facebook, Twitter. We've got a site revision at the moment. Got a fantastic web designer, William Barton. He's the head of front-end design at The Hive. Fantastic, you know, he built, you know, PG Tips and all that kind of stuff. So, you know, he's the guy. Also my brother-in-law, so I have to be nice.
You have to be nice, yeah.
But yeah, all my details are online, easy to find. So
excellent. Well, Johnny Pawlik, Mantra Media, thanks very much for joining us today.
We're open for business life.